Good afternoon, this is Stephen McCarthy from the McCarthy Project, and we have been talking about movement in space. We have talked with Jack Woodrup from Vertical Jumping and Sean Miska, and I am totally looking forward to our next guest. His name is Andy Barr. He is currently the performance coach for the New York Knicks, which I'll let him kind of expand what that role really means. But just to kind of step back, he also has a very extensive history in the world of soccer. He has looked at the body and how it performs for a very long time. And one of the things that I've kind of asked him to come on the show is to talk about injury prevention and about creating structure that is working properly before you go ahead and put the big pressure on it. So, Andy, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, thanks. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Absolutely. I have we've been kind of exchanging emails for a while, so I was very excited that it worked out. Now that the season's over, I'm sure things hopefully calm down a little bit for you during the off season.
Yeah, I mean, it is crazy intense in the season just with the traveling and the amount of games. So it's, you know, it's nice to have a little bit of downtime now and just start to think about a lot of other stuff and prepare for the following season. So it's nice to just relax a little bit and recover and regenerate myself.
Exactly. All right, before we go into the details, as everybody can already tell, you have an accent. And I'm sure the inevitable question always gets asked, you know, because you don't have, I'm sure you don't have earphones on your ears or something along this line right out the chute, but you actually are UK. So kind of give us a little bit of your background before we go into a little bit of the details.
Yeah, sure. From England. I was born and bred in Birmingham and moved down to London to play actually professional soccer for a team called Luton Town when I was 16. Didn't quite make it due to injuries. So I decided to take another career pathway and went and trained as a physical therapist. Fortunately, when I was trained as a physical therapist, I networked with a lot of people that were still playing football or soccer, so to speak, and I managed to get a job in professional soccer straight out of university, fortunately with a team that was at the forefront of sports science and medicine at the time, which was Bolton Wanderers. They had a fantastic reputation for optimizing player fitness and wellness and making success within the league based on those measures as opposed to just working on talent. They didn't really have quite the finance of the other teams, but we optimized the staff and tried to keep our players as healthy as possible by preventing injuries and being proactive in our philosophy. And by doing that, we had great success on the field. And the team went from being a favoured team to be eliminated from the league, the Premier League, we call relegation, to actually being very successful year in, year out and competing in European football. So from there, from learning a lot of good trade and a good foundation of what sports science and medicine and strength and conditioning is about, I actually went to work for another number of other different teams to try and implement a similar sort of philosophy, and had great success. I worked at Southampton Football Club, had a similar sort of influence there in terms of reducing injury rates, and ended up working for Manchester City Football Club. That was the last team I worked for, and had a very proactive role there too, before I ended up being headhunted by the Knicks to try and introduce my philosophy here. I worked in the Premier League for 10 years, different teams.
Because I'm sure that's always the inevitable question. How does a guy that has a strong background in soccer from the UK end up at the New York Knicks? It just doesn't seem to match in some ways.
Well, yeah, I know. It's kind of a unique story, really. And I always had a fascination of working in American sport. And my wife is actually American, so we definitely had a desire to move here. And when I was working at Manchester City, I had a work project that was to try and source out the best facilities around the world because they were building their own training center. So while I was on the road looking at different training facilities, the Knicks was one of the facilities that I visited. And coincidentally, there was another English guy working here named Dave Hancock. And I knew that he had moved over to work with the Knicks as a physical therapist. And when I came here and we got chatting, he really loved my skill set. And he basically recommended me to the organization for someone to come in and, you know, look after the injury prevention and performance enhancement side of the Knicks program. So within a month, I had a phone call from the head of the department, and they asked me to come over and meet with the head coach and the president at the time. And the following week, I was handing my notice at Manchester City, and a month later, I was doing my second pre-season with a professional team. In a different
well,
sport,
that's,
in a different
that's a small change, you know. That's not like just moving from one suburb to the other.
No. So it was a real nice transition, to be honest. And I really, you know, enjoy working in basketball. And there was a lot of similarities, and then a lot of obviously huge differences. Not just the size of the players, but mainly the actual travel intensity that these guys are exposed to. It was very eye opening. Very fun.
It is an amazing thing. But one thing, before we go on to kind of get to the nuts and bolts of the show, define for us what a performance coach, what the role of the performance coach in a, let's just say, a North American professional team.
Yeah. So my role right now, so I'm basically here to try and assess the players for injury risk. So I use a number of things that help me do that, a number of tools. I mainly look at the movement control, the body awareness, and the ability to decelerate movement. And then I look at range of motion restrictions, and then just imbalances, strength deficiencies, and then a few other measures, which I won't go into. But I utilize all these assessment tools, and then I basically integrate the findings into their strength and conditioning programs and what we do in recovery sessions and what we do in warm-ups, and also help to influence what the coaches do in certain drills that they do. So I try and be as proactive as I possibly can with the information I get and develop programs to try and, one, optimize performance, but also to keep the guys as ready and fresh as possible throughout the season. And a lot of that is integration and communication with the different departments.
Because what you're talking about, as I understand it, really is a very much of almost like the glue that holds the whole picture together. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not a something that, as we get a little bit further in the conversation, hopefully you'll share a little bit about what you actually do. But the area of injury prevention is probably almost like the technology box, and you're the guy in the box nobody sees, you know, doing all this work, but it's actually helping the guys perform at a higher level. Or if that makes sense, hopefully that analogy works, where you're the guy in the box nobody sees, but you're the one that makes the whole thing work.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many aspects to performance, to optimal performance, you know, and like obviously the physical aspect is something that the sports science, medical and strength and conditioning department can be very influential in. And the more that the information that we have is utilized and integrated into, you know, the performance programs of these players, the less risk they're at of being injured, and the more effective the fitness programs and conditioning programs can be. So, you know, what I try and do is I highlight as many deficiencies as I possibly can, and then we come up with like a priority program, and then that is really as being as specific as possible what we need to do to try and get these guys at their peak. But yeah, you're right, it's just like I try and integrate and glue everything together, and we try and work as an interdisciplinary team as much as possible, because that's the most effective practice in my experience, and that's really how I've been so successful, as working together and linking all the departments in just to, you know, optimize performance, because everybody has something to offer. You know, everybody has something to offer in terms of helping the athlete. But what is the most important? Well, they're all as equally as important. So why don't we all just pull the ideas to get the best outcome to, you know, optimize those athletes?
Exactly. Because I think this is one of the biggest concepts that I think in North American medical community is that they are thinking compartmentalization rather than goals. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and everybody specializes in one area rather than looking at the comprehensive picture. One of the a friend of mine is Dr. Sandel, who actually was a chiropractor for the Olympics and has the resume not unlike yourself. But he is the one, that first one that told me that about 8 or 9 years ago. He says, you know what, you have to think in wholes. You can't think as I'm a surgeon, I'm a strength coach, I'm a chiropractor, you know, that kind of thing. You have to see the whole picture. And I think if you are looking, like, and this, I'm going to pose this question because I'm kind of going to set you up on the tee, so to speak. But if you're in a position where you need help, what would you look for in a trainer, in a coach, based on what we just talked about?
I think the number one would be no ego and complete open-mindedness. Have a good, you know, philosophy that is structured and logical in progressions, not too extreme, but mainly somebody who's flexible enough to, you know, take on board advice from every other, clinician or practitioner that's out there to advance themselves, and somebody's open-minded and always willing to learn, and never, you know, satisfied with what they're doing, but someone who's enthusiastic with the skills they have, but keen to always develop. I think that's super important. That would be
cool.
My key thing.
Yes, and I think that's the biggest piece that I see sometimes. That, you know, when you do your research on more the Soviet method of training, you see the role that the performance coach or they didn't call them strength coaches, but, you know, that head director of athletic development, he was the coach, you know, and he's the one that saw all the areas, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But in the United States, we've almost got it flipped over backwards, where the coach is a coach but really doesn't understand how performance works and really don't have any idea how to prevent injury.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And isn't it? Everyone wants just their own little piece of the puzzle, and they don't want to share, and people get very territorial. And then, you know, you can't be as effective. And it's about, at the end of the day, it's not about us as practitioners. The number one thing is about how can we help our athletes get better, and how can we keep them healthy, and how can we maximize their potential. That's the number one thing. That's why we're here. No other reason.
Yeah. Done. All right. So now let's go over to some specifics, because the thing that we're talking about is movement in space, you know, and just under that general heading, I'm going to put this down into the injury prevention or assessment position, because give us your thoughts on the starting point of trying to make your movements in space as efficient as possible.
So I think, you know, there's a number of factors that are important to optimizing your movement efficiency. Now, I think it stems from having great body awareness. So the better body awareness you have allows you to deal with the various situations that your body is exposed to during sport. Now, when you play sport, there's so many different instances. You may think that you're doing the same movement repeatedly, but it's very rare that you perform that same movement. So the more equipped you are to deal with multiple different types of movement in multiple different situations, the less at risk you are of being injured. Now, the biggest thing that I try and focus on, or one of the things that I'm really keen to emphasize, is your ability to decelerate movement and control your body momentum in the direction of the inertia. So your ability to slow that down, it allows you to move a lot more efficiently in the direction that you want to go to, whereas a lot of times we focus too much on the movement and acceleration and production of force, as opposed to how do we slow down that movement to absorb the movement to then accelerate away. Because the more you can produce stiffness in the initial phases of an action, the more you can utilize your elastic capacity and your elastic energy, or your tendons and the elastic tissues. So I really believe that optimizing your deceleration capabilities, but also optimizing the muscles that are specifically designed to provide optimal deceleration control. So the muscles that are often overlooked or not utilized enough, the stabilizing muscles, the muscles that are closer to the joint, the muscles that perform or provide more stiffness, provide more rotation control in the transverse plane, that provide more sensitivity to postural recruitment and postural stability, and provide good alignment control. Those muscles are the muscles that can really help with the deceleration capability, the ability to slow down before you speed up, and use your more explosive type muscles. So I think having great body awareness, fantastic alignment control, and good muscle balance between the muscles that are designed to slow you down and the muscles that are designed to speed you up is essential when you're talking about movement efficiency and movement control.
Because let's talk about something that is outside of the world of basketball so that you can feel comfortable to comment. But, you know, Robert Griffin III, you know, had his recent ACL problems. You know, obviously it's well documented. I have been told, I haven't actually seen it, but a friend of mine that does a lot of these assessments says there's a picture on the internet of him doing a squat or a deadlift. And his knees are caving. You know what I mean? And give us your thoughts in general about something like that. Is that obvious? Is a major, you know?
Yeah. I mean, for starters, like my philosophy would be let's train for what the game entails. Now, how often do we need maximal effort? Most of the time it's submaximal, and a lot of times it's in a rotational plane. And ACL injuries are often injured by a rotational force, rotational component. So in order to protect and to rehab and prevent, we should be focused on the muscles that are designed to control rotational forces and asymmetrical forces. Now, a lot of time, if you're just doing a squat with your knees caving in, first of all, it's in the sagittal plane. It's in a, you know, and it's a symmetrical training method. So you're going to get, you know, strength development of certain muscle groups, but to protect the ACL, and if the knee's caving in, then that's obviously a sign that there's poor rotation control at the hip. So the hip muscles aren't controlling those rotational transverse forces. So if you can't control it when you're doing a sagittal motion, then just think what it's going to be like when you're actually on a pitch or on the field doing twist and turning motions when you're subconsciously not even thinking about what your knee's doing. So my thoughts are, like, obviously when you're doing a sagittal type exercise like a squat, you need to have good alignment control and awareness of what's going on with your knee. But then really I would be looking at doing submaximal type of rotational exercises where you're consistently challenging rotation but allowing to control movement into and out of the rotational plane. First of all, you have to know how to control the rotation, stop the rotation in that plane by challenging it, and then you can move in and out of it and put yourself into circumstances that you might be within a game situation. But, you know, I think it's essential that you have the awareness of the hip muscles that are actually the muscles that are going to protect that rotational force around the knee joint, and not just focus on the muscles that are going to flex and extend the knee. And I think that's often overlooked when people are looking at preventing ACL or strength or rehabbing ACL type injuries.
All right, so now let's go to the opposite side. So we're going to use the same example, you know, of Robert Griffin. Say he doesn't have that type of a squat going on to start with. How would you improve his performance, or what would you look for? And I know you don't know his particular case, if you will, but kind of give us some thought about what you would be looking for, because I'm very curious.
Yeah, so obviously that's just a symmetrical squat, and hopefully he would be able to perform like a basic movement such as a squat by keeping good alignment. What I'd like to do is challenge my athletes with various movements that are similar to the movements that they will perform when they're playing, like a hop with rotation or a lunge, quick lunge with a fast feet exchange or a drop step, and ask them to consciously control different segments of their body. Now, if they can control those segments of their body, then I know they have good movement efficiency. But if they can't control them consciously, then I know that there's a weak link within that kinetic chain that needs to be improved. So what I'll do then is I'll work back and say, well, what movements need to work, what muscles need to be worked more efficiently or need to be stimulated more efficiently within certain exercises to provide better control. And I'll develop my program based around, you know, what I find from that type of test. So I'd look at a method of testing using what I call dissociative movements, and that gives me direction specific related information on where the movement fault is. So I know whether somebody doesn't control hip flexion very well, or hip medial rotation, or ankle dorsiflexion, ankle inversion, or shoulder, you know, internal rotation. So there's like lots of different tests that I'll use to try and highlight where that movement fault may be. And then that can give me, you know, a great indication of where they do not decelerate well, where they don't control very alignment very well in more of a sports specific movement instance. Like sports that I'm familiar with are mainly biased to asymmetrical and rotational movements. So you need to test it in those planes of motion to really see whether there's any risk there.
All right, now the next question, as long as we're talking basketball, because everybody does want to jump high and everybody wants to dunk, if you will.
Yeah.
Is there a way in your mind to look at somebody that maybe doesn't have, you know, a very big vertical jump that would like to gain one? Are there things that they can do, or is it something that if you can just naturally jump high, genetically you're predisposed, you're an outlier, you can jump?
Yeah, I think, and I know some of the research has shown this, I think if you can jump high, then you've got more potential to jump higher. If you can't, then you can do all the power training you want, but your ability to improve is limited. So, you know, that's how my take would be. I think I'm not really, that fussed about trying to get someone to improve their jump height. I think, you know, that's not really the focus of what I try and do when I'm developing the athletes. I think I use jump testing to look at what they dominate with, whether it's more elastic potential or strength. But I use it more for fatigue analysis a lot of the time, and see how long they're like staying on the floor for when I'm doing certain jump tests. But a lot, to be honest, when I'm working in basketball, you don't really get you want to try and avoid doing as much jumping when you can, because they jump enough when they're on the court. So I want to try and protect the tendons and trying to eliminate too much jump training. Obviously, you need to do it at certain stages for development, but
interesting, because
how much you can actually improve someone's jump height, I think it's limited.
It's funny, because one of the things that you just said was confirmed as well with Jack Woodrup. He said one of the things that I'm starting to tell young basketball players is, if you want to jump higher, don't play basketball quite as much, because they are playing so much.
They're just fatiguing themselves.
Yeah. Yes, and they never have a chance to recover, and it just really does go downhill fast.
Yeah, and that's the biggest thing. It's like, and I think with any young athlete trying to develop and improve, it's your loading patterns is the number one thing you need to look at. So how often you train and what you do and when you train. I think a lot of the times people think it's great to work hard, but it's better to work smart. You know, and you know, you see people doing 2-a-day practices and doing this, and you know, and then doing your strength and conditioning sessions and like getting your plyometrics, and it's just like, well, you know, you need to have a work rest ratio, but that is allowing for adaptation and allowing for development, because if you don't get that, it's like trying to build a house, and then as soon as you like lay the cement, you're not giving it enough time to set before you put the bricks on. And then, you know, it's just like constantly working tissues that aren't recovered. So if you keep working tissues that aren't recovered, then you're not going to get adaptation, and, you know, you're just going to end up either less effective performance-wise or more than likely injured. And that's where you see a lot of overuse injuries. And it also affects growth. And there's some, like, really good research coming out now in terms of people that are training excessively during – you know, adolescence, it actually affects the growth rates through the year, and they end up trying to catch up when they're not playing, and they have like growth spurts rather than like equal ratio growth. So I'm a big believer in, you know, making sure that the program load is managed effectively as a number one, and that's something that I think is very often overlooked and not seen as important as it should be.
It's kind of funny because you mentioned that is when I started 10 years ago in this world of training young athletes, my family was young at the same time, and when my older son finally, you know, got to be in the probably 9 to 11 year range, I don't know exactly when. But he was going to be a killer, you know. I'm going to just develop the machine of the century, you know. And I started in, and he was always gung-ho. I mean, this kid, I honestly did want to do it.
Yeah.
He was willing. But then all of a sudden, he'd get a little nicky neck. His knees would hurt a little bit. And then we'd back off, and then they would get better. And then the next time, you know, all of a sudden, I'm doing the plyometric thing, and then he's got a little problem in his hip. You know, and I'm like, dang, dude, what's going on here? This is not the way this is supposed to work. You know what I mean? And it was interesting because I finally made the realization. I said, okay, let's just stop for a while. Let's see, wait for his body to kind of show me that it can handle the wear and tear.
Yeah.
And it took me to wait till he was 15. And then finally, in his ninth grade year, he showed that he could go in 4 or 5 days a week with practice. And then I was then able to add a strength day, and then I added 2, and he's been fine ever since. But again, he was one kid that you needed to back off a little bit, and he's done just fine. He's just as strong as everybody else. He didn't lose the edge or anything like that related to it. And I think in today's world, so many people are thinking that they're going to miss the boat, so to speak, if they don't jump on now, and they need to realize that their kids actually maybe need that time to grow, need that time to relax and allow their body to grow the way it normally should.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. And, you know, kids are developing at different speeds. And you just got to be very careful. You got to really protect the kids because, you know, they're just so immature and so fragile. You have to make sure that you're not overloading them and you're just allowing them to enjoy the sport and, you know, have time to adapt and grow and, you know, just find their body and just figure out, like, what are the most important things right now? You know, that they their body develops, you know, systematically at different phases. So, like, let's focus on the things that they're going to be more effective at developing at through that stage. So let's not, like, load them up when they're going through, you know, that growth stage. Let's load them up at a later stage when they're a bit more robust. Let's, like, focus more on things like skill development, technique, control, body awareness, the things that are going to give them a good foundation and basis for the training further down the line. I think, you know, that's often, you know, so overlooked, and it's just so important to get that foundation will help them then their longevity through the later career. I'm doing stuff now with guys where I wish these guys were doing this from the age of like 5 to 15, and then they start doing, you know, some more heavy loading and more focused stuff, because you're just working on the wrong things at the wrong time, and it just gets really out of proportion and doesn't set them up for, you know, a longevity or much longevity in their career.
All right, we've got to go to a quick break, Andy. If people would like to get in touch with you, I know that you do some teaching, and if people are interested in or maybe have a question, where can they get a hold of you?
I'll give you my email address. It's andybarr@innovateperformance.com. That's the best place to contact me. But yeah, I'll be more than happy to answer or get back to you if there's any interesting questions. I'm not sure how quickly I'll be able to respond, but yeah, feel free to contact.
I know, trust me, the time. But yes, anyways, well, thank you, Andy, very much for coming on the show today. Best of luck in the season. I know you guys had a kind of a breakout year this year. Things seem to go the right direction for sure, and you just can't beat the Timberwolves. That's one of their jobs. You know.
Well, I'll let them know.
All right, man.
Thanks so much. I really enjoyed it.
Have a good day.
Thank you. Take care.